Hello and welcome back to a Friday edition of The Damage Report with Brett Ehrlich.
Oh, I'm so happy to be
bring
here.
Bring in the funnies.
If you guys want even more funnies, just to go through your entire day, not only are John and I on this show together now, but John will be on main show first hour as normal. But John and I get back together for happy half hour later on today at 5 p.m. for people who watch our streaming networks.
It was and a fun episode.
Members, you could just on demand it. Why was John on the show? Who canceled ahead of time that John so graciously stepped in for? Maybe if you watch the show, you'll find out. But for all the people who did tweet me questions to ask John, there will be a web only and members only, depending on how you look at it, video where we do that. And it was quite a lot of fun.
It was very fun.
We did it at the
end. Drank whiskey.
After the whiskey drinking.
Exactly, exactly.
John's
someday.
Your John's classy take on whiskey, which is to add cherry Coke.
You couldn't. You're pointing that out on multiple shows now. Okay. Yeah. Don't watch it. It was terrible.
It was really good.
But anyway,
really
you funny. Should watch this though. I mean, you are. Why stop now? Why change horses mid-show?
Despite our best efforts.
We're working on it. No, we've got. It's going to be a fun episode. Star Wars is going to get ruined. So if you like Star Wars, you won't anymore. That'll be fun. Cable. So this is basically the falling apart of the mainstream media. We've got a voice who says everyone in America should be forcibly injected with coronavirus. And we have perhaps the most embarrassing segment ever on CNN or MSNBC. Like, I think that that's safe to say. We'll get into it. But
no matter who you are.
Shut down the channel for a day.
At some point, you will be embarrassed.
Exactly,
For a number of reasons.
Yes. But let's start off with something at least semi-serious before we get to all the frivolity. Donald Trump had a little town hall last night where he was being asked questions by Fox News. And in that, he let kind of a big bomb slip out. Take a look.
But the place.
Would this would be a focus of a second term?
Oh, absolutely. But when the trade deals kick in, now again, we were disturbed by what's going on with the virus, but that's going to be fine, and everybody, it's going to be fine. But, you know, that was a disturbance. But I will say this, when these trade deals kick in, and when all, you know, the economy is the best economy we've ever had. It's nothing compared to what it's going to be when the trade deals kick in.
But if you don't cut something in entitlements, you'll never really deal with the debt.
We'll be cutting, but we're also going to have growth like you've never had before. We've never had growth like we're experiencing. We will be.
So in response to Martha McCollum saying, yeah, but without cutting entitlements, you'll never, you know, cut the national debt down, which he'd been rambling about. He said, oh, we'll be cutting. We'll be cutting.
Yeah, and
so did he say that or did he not say it? Because we heard him say it, but you're about to hear a whole bunch of people say that he didn't say that.
Yeah, play that over and over again until the election. That's all people need. That's one of the many things that people need to do, no matter who the candidate is. Over and over and over again until the election. Make the conversation about that. Make the conversation about you can't trust Trump to look out for you.
Mm-hmm. And we'll give you more reasons to believe that a little bit later on. And by the way, we're not gonna dwell on, although I understand that one of the concerns over Joe Biden being the nominee is that he has previously said that those programs should be cut. So we'll go more in depth into that at some point. But for today, we wanna focus on Donald Trump. But yeah, he said it. Now, today he's saying he didn't say that. He tweeted, I will protect your Social Security and Medicare just as I have for the past 3 years. Sleepy Joe Biden will destroy both in very short order and he won't even know he's doing it. So that last part, just get ready for the fact that if he's the nominee, he's gonna be portrayed and he will do some of the portraying that he will be mentally incapable of knowing what he's even doing. So that's what Trump is trying to put out there.
Which is insane. And especially if you just listen to Trump's answer that we just played, it is a bunch of restarts because he doesn't know what he's saying. He doesn't know how to say it. He can't figure out which stupid ad nauseum repeated talking point he's going to bring out to these people who are asking him questions at the town hall. Because it's a little different than what he's used to. Typically, it's just him doing his 2-hour stand-up routine for everybody.
Nobody's interrupting. Just whatever he wants.
And he did interrupt a lot to say terrible, terrible, like stupid, jokey things. In that same event, I think he said about Obama, like, yeah, I had one conversation with him and that was enough for me. And everyone's like, I saw him at a funeral.
Hey, were your arms tired?
He's like, have you seen him since? He's like, I saw him at a funeral and I said hello and goodbye. That's like Trump's quote. But like the, the point is, we're talking about the economy. We're talking about people being alive because these main economic talking points are, can people afford to put food on the table? And are you going to let them die from coronavirus? And will that affect the economy? And he is not a serious person to be handling
any
of that.
No, and yeah, as you said, it was just ad nauseum, like throwing up restart. And rarely has ad nauseum been as nauseaming. He was asked about the national debt, which has gone up by like $3 trillion, even though he said he would wipe it out almost immediately. And he said, well, you know, the economy's the best ever. And oh, by the way, coronavirus, that really hit us. I mean, it happened after the $3 trillion. But yeah, that really did it. And then, well, when the trade deals happen, that's gonna be amazing and all that. But anyway, I want to focus on the cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Stephanie Grisham responded to news about it by saying fake news. He was talking about cutting deficits, not entitlements. But that's not, well, technically, he was talking about cutting deficits by cutting entitlements.
Right, he was talking about.
Well, we have the actual, exact White House transcript.
There you go.
Question, but if you don't cut something in entitlements, you'll never really deal with the debt. The president, oh, we'll be cutting, but we're also going to have growth like you've never had before. She said, if you don't cut something in entitlements, you'll never really deal with the debt. So if you don't cut this, you're not going to cut that. Oh, we'll be cutting.
And he's lying because that's what everybody, like, that is already a Republican talking point, which is we do need to cut entitlements. Those are, the Republicans are relying on just ridiculous Trump rhetoric, the other stuff that I mentioned, the Obama jokes and everything, to carry him through with the Trump base, just general rhetoric. Because a lot of that Trump base relies on entitlement programs.
Yeah.
They are not like college graduates who have white collar jobs. These are people who are struggling to find, even if they have a job, the kind of job that will pay them enough to put food on the table.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he's angling at with that, but I just, it's
well,
very
also,
frustrating.
Yeah, look, it's he's on tape saying it, but honestly, like you don't even need that because this is not a new thing. I know that he keeps saying, oh, I'm always, just like he says, I'm gonna protect pre-existing conditions, even though they tried desperately to remove those protections. You remember his 2020 budget? Over the next 10 years, his budget proposal aims to spend $1.5 trillion less on Medicaid, instead allocating $1.2 trillion in a block grant program to states, so that's hundreds of billions of dollars in cuts, $25 billion less on Social Security, $845 billion less on Medicare. And that wasn't, you also had, headlines going around. Everybody should already know about this. Trump opens doors to cuts to Medicare and other entitlement programs. Like, that was 3 weeks ago, and now it's like, wait a second. He's gonna cut entitlements? No, he already proposed it in his budget. That's it. Now the budget hasn't passed, it likely won't pass in that form, but that is his goal. And he wants it so bad that he would put it in a budget that's not even going to pass.
It's weird because the reason, the talk about cutting entitlement programs has always seemed to be just a way to keep poor people down. But it really is a way to argue against Democrats who are raising taxes.
Mm-hmm.
Trump has lowered taxes. I think the priority for deficit handling for Republicans was only kind of something that hung on a discussion about taxes as lowering, like how expensive it is to have Democrats in office.
Mm-hmm.
And now that Trump is the person who is in office, who has given them tax cuts, no one really cares about the deficit anymore.
No, they definitely don't.
There is no Democrat to talk about. And what it has done, because it just seems like they have this zombie talking point they like to bring up. Who are they arguing against?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who are they arguing against? The only people they're arguing against are people in the financial sector who see like a potential recession coming and think that a way to reduce the deficit as a way to seem responsible in a coming recession is to reduce entitlement spending.
Yeah, they don't care. They're not even, they're barely pretending to care now. The second a Democrat gets in office, the Tea Party will come back and suddenly the national debt will be the most important thing in the world.
Yeah, that's it.
That's the cycle, we know it exists. Okay, let's turn now to a very different sort of topic. Funny on one level, sad in another. I've always liked Star Wars, but I like it less today, and I blame two billionaires for that. So Mike Bloomberg, after dropping out of the race and endorsing Joe Biden, he tweeted this out, "See you soon, Donald." And it was that scene of Obi-Wan Kenobi fighting Darth Vader in A New Hope.
If you strike me down, I shall only rise up stronger, something like that.
Exactly, exactly. So he is Obi-Wan Kenobi in this? No, that's bad enough. But Donald Trump, I mean, he wasn't going to get memed by Mike Bloomberg. And so, just a day later, he tweets out this. Mini Mike, you're easy. Do we have the video? I don't know if we can play the video. If we have it, let's play it.
I don't think we do.
I don't think we can. And it's so they very roughly Adobe premiered on the faces onto a Spaceballs clip.
Yeah.
And this was the interaction between these two people who don't understand Star Wars at all.
It is, yeah. It's the clip for those listening to the podcast of when Dark Helmet is trying to swing his Schwartz at Lone Star, but Lone Star puts his hand on Dark Helmet's head and he can't swing at it. It is so stupid. The only accurate part about this, the memes of Bloomberg and Trump in the original Star Wars Obi-Wan versus Darth Vader is just how terrible that sword fight is.
Yes, it's pretty
it
bad.
Is just a bunch of like kids in the backyard like intentionally crossing swords.
No, I was better.
And then someone just being like, I don't need to win this.
Yeah, no, it was pretty pathetic. So what I like about that, the only thing I like about that is that that really does show how like, you know how like memes were like what young people did or whatever, and now anyone can make it. So like clever people might make some in the past and now anyone can make them. The right, they make memes and they're very enthusiastic about it. If you go to like, if you watch like the Talking Points USA things, they have like panels on how great they are at making memes.
And the best,
but there's
ones,
there's some what?
The best memes are the memed Talking Points USA posters of just Charlie Kirk standing there
exactly.
And then something ridiculous.
But there's something missing here. Like they were so jealous of how AOC could just rip people apart. And they want that. And they want to believe that they have that. And so when Trump tweeted the mini Mike, you're easy, they all retweeted it. And you can look, Dave Rubin like literally died laughing. They all think like, oh, they got him. But no, AOC might like do a meme or something, but after getting them, it's a reference to the get. Just putting the video up, that's not anything. That doesn't mean anything. He says, you're easy. But not in reference to the fact that he actually pointed something out that made Mike Bloomberg look bad or destroyed him in some way. It's literally just the meme. But they so fundamentally don't understand comedy that they think just a reference. Like if Trump just tweeted out an image of the Anchorman, he got him.
There's nothing more frustrating than people who think that quoting a movie is a joke.
By itself.
It happens. I used to play, my friends were all like SC frat boy, like recent graduates, and they'd play volleyball. It was like that scene from frickin' Top Gun.
I play volleyball, but yes.
At beach volleyball, but it was just like, hey, way to go, loser. Like they're just, they think they're telling jokes, but you're just doing movie quotes. That's someone else's joke. Eventually, you should get to the point where you have your own things. I disagree. I think Trump is fun, can be funny in a way that understands his own audience, the same way that I know that there is a comedic strain to the blue collar comedy tour of like Larry the Cable Guy. There's jokes he knows how to tell to his audience to make them laugh. I just hate picturing what it must be like to be the kind of person who finds that funny. Like there's a, my friend used to read New Yorker cartoons out loud in a way that revealed how desperate you'd have to be as a human being to find them funny.
Yeah.
And we'd be like, I went to the sushi bar and I ended up getting eaten raw.
There's a bit of that to this.
All of that is like, gotcha, Donald. It's like, no, you didn't. And it's not funny.
And look, yeah, Donald's bad here. He's not the only one. Bloomberg, you're just the worst. Like that wasn't funny either. See you soon. No, but you did have a pathetic end to your run. It was really bad. And you're not gonna rise up strong. You've got your money, sure. You can shower money on him, but that's not you being tough or strong or cool. I'm gonna lose it. We gotta move on.
I just disagree because I do think Mike Bloomberg has made some of the best ads of this cycle. And if he's using his powers for good instead of evil in a general election, not between now and then, but in a general election, save your money till when it matters.
Okay. Yeah. At some point, Joe Biden will be scooping ice cream in a really awkward way and honking the snout of a dog. Okay, we gotta go. We got a lot more after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR.
As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
There is a lot on the line in this presidential election. One of the biggest things at stake is the possibility of finally doing something about the climate crisis. And one of the best plans that's been put forward to deal with it is the Green New Deal. And that is why I could not be more thrilled to invite onto the show our next guest, one of the architects of the Green New Deal and the Vice President for Data for Progress, Julian Brave Noisecat. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very glad to have you here. There's a lot that I want to learn about, but I want to start with the process of putting together the Green New Deal. What were the origins? How did it evolve over time?
The Green New Deal really came out of two conversations. The first was this conversation about how we were going to get a popular and really a populist climate policy across the finish line. So backtrack to 2018, this is before the climate strikes, this is before the election of AOC. Climate is generally considered like a tertiary issue for Democrats. And we were all, as climate advocates and wonks, concerned about how we were going to get this issue to the top of the agenda. And back then, the leading thinking was through something called a federal job guarantee, the notion that the government would become an employer of last resort for people in the economy. And so we started this conversation about a job guarantee at the same time. This was before the Democratic midterms in 2018. And there was a bunch of candidates, including Ocasio-Cortez, who were running on this thing called a Green New Deal. And those two things sort of combined, this conversation about jobs and the climate crisis. And by November, we kind of coalesced on calling this sort of package that we were developing the Green New Deal.
You know, I'm curious on your read on, as you point out, it was at that point like a tertiary issue at best. And now it's one of the most high profile issues, not necessarily on the debate stage to my endless frustration, but for people thinking about, you know, what needs to happen in this election. And I'm curious, like, it felt like the protest outside of Nancy Pelosi's office was the turning point on that. Do you think that that might be the case? Do you think that it was putting a name and a label on this program, that it needed that sort of identifiable brand almost? What do you think we can attribute the rise in importance and talk around this issue to?
I think that those are definitely two very important parts of it. The naming a solution that was appealing to people and that had brand name recognition, the Green New Deal, that was important. The sit-in in Speaker Pelosi's office, also important. I think from a broader perspective though, you have to remember that I think the climate crisis is becoming actually much more visceral and felt by people. This used to be something that we thought of as something that was far off in the future. But then we saw a city that was called Paradise literally turned into hell on earth inside of 30 minutes. We saw thousands of people in Puerto Rico die. You know, there are increasing wildfires across the West Coast and across the country, flooding, hurricanes, all sorts of natural disasters. And I think that people are seeing these things coming closer and closer to impacting themselves and their lives, or have been touched by these disasters. And I think that that is making this threat of climate change feel so much more imminent. At the same time, I think that the rising activism of this, so the climate strikes, the Sunrise Movement, really the youth-led push to do something about climate change, which has finally broken through, has sort of made people sort of wake up to this crisis. And then lastly, I think that there have been some moments of really important research and reports and synthesis of the latest science that have come out, in particular, the United Nations report on warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius. This is the document that led to people talking about that we have 12 years thing. Mm-hmm. I think some of your listeners and viewers might have remembered that we have 12 years thing. That report in of itself seems to have created a moment that lurched a lot of the key sort of communicators on this, whether that be scientists or experts or politicians, to really start ringing the alarm bells because it is an alarming situation now. And I think those things combined have sort of brought climate into this new moment of importance.
You know, so as we've been saying, a lot of people have been talking about it, even on the news, although I've seen some, at least last year, some analyses saying that it looked like Fox News was talking about it more than CNN and MSNBC. Probably I'm going to go out on a limb and say not in a productive way. So how have you felt, how have you reacted to the sort of strike back against the Green New Deal, the way the right has been talking about it, some of the misinformation that's been spread?
This is a really concerning issue, I think, for everyone on the left side of the aisle. For so long, the debate on climate change was defined by, you know, belief or disbelief. You know, you had one side that was saying the science is real and another side that was effectively tinfoil hat people who are saying, you know, this is all fake. And unfortunately, that means that the folks who are supposed to be advocates on this, you know, the Democratic Party, the left side of the aisle, were able to get away with simply just saying, oh yeah, we believe the science. And that was kind of where the conversation ended. We never got into more detail about what this could look like. And so I think that we, as experts and advocates, as people who are more engaged in politics, who go into the media and talk about these things, have a real responsibility to educate the public about what climate action could look like and how it could benefit the economy, how it could benefit everyday people like you and me, how it's going to produce jobs, all of that sort of stuff. And I think that we are now into that stage of the conversation, of the debate, where, you know, there are going to be an understanding of differences between different approaches to climate change, and a huge role that the Green New Deal has played and can continue to play is in sort of driving a positive conversation about what decarbonization, what mitigation, and what adaptation to a warming planet might look like. But a huge part of that is also going to be fighting back right-wing propaganda. You know, there's a huge business interest in this country in describing anything that aims to rein in emissions as Venezuela-style socialism, as an attack on the American way of life. And part of our role on the left side of the aisle, on people who produce policy about this, is to refute those lies.
You know, and I'm curious too. I know that you're obviously coming into this from the point of view of, you know, helping to craft the policy, wanting to see it through. It's looking like going forward, and you pointed out we don't have much time, that for the next 4 years, one of three people, it's looking like, is going to be in charge of whatever our response to the climate crisis is. It's either going to be Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, or Joe Biden. What do you think about those three possible futures when it comes to what might happen with the Green New Deal?
So there's only of those candidates one who has endorsed the Green New Deal, and that is, of course, Senator Sanders. He has a $16 trillion climate plan that aims to produce immense amounts of jobs, to rein in emissions, and to really remake the infrastructure of this country into clean and green infrastructure. So I would say that Senator Sanders has the best and most ambitious approach to the challenge. On the other end, of course, Donald Trump, until very recently, was describing climate change as, quote, a hoax invented by the Chinese. So I think that we know what's in store in a Trump presidency. I think it's probably more attacks on science, more denial of the problem. And that really effectively just means that we dig ourselves deeper and deeper into a quite apocalyptic hole, because this issue, unlike other issues, isn't just one where, you know, it festers over time, and it remains the same in 2024 as it is in 2021. No, in fact, actually, the longer we take to rein in emissions, the graver the future is and the present is going to be for all of us. So that's a big consideration. I would say that Joe Biden, he to his credit put forward a fairly comprehensive climate plan, actually, after being pretty roundly criticized by groups, including the Sunrise Movement. It was a weak point for him early on in the primary that he tried to correct for. My biggest concern is that Biden is a little bit too close to some of the fossil fuel corporations and interests, and that unlike Senator Sanders, he would be, I think, unwilling to take on some of those more vested big oil money in our politics. And my personal view is that in the same way that if you wanted, healthcare reform, there's no way to do that without taking on big pharma. If you want climate policy, if you want climate action, and certainly if you want a Green New Deal, there's really no way to do that without taking on big oil.
I am right there with you on that. Julian Noyce-Katt, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to take a short break here. When we come back, the coronavirus, it's a tragedy, possibly requiring drastic action, but CNBC has exactly the wrong sort of drastic action after this. For weeks now, CNBC has been grappling with the apparent economic damage being done by international concern over the spread of coronavirus, and it sometimes leads to them saying kind of crazy things. Take a look.
Think about how the world would be if you tried to quarantine everybody because of the generic type flu. Now, I'm not saying this is the generic type flu, but maybe we'd be just better off if we gave it to everybody. And then in a month it would be over because the mortality rate of this probably isn't going to be any different if we did it that way than the long-term picture. But the difference is we're wreaking havoc on global and domestic.
Right. So that was Rick Santelli apparently saying, correct me if I'm wrong, that it would be better for the economy, which is after all the ultimate good in the world, that we infect everyone in America with coronavirus to get it over with.
But like, this is everything. What you just saw was everything.
Was I being unfair there? Is that what he said?
It's like the theme of the last week has been people being so, and maybe the last 2 years, 3.5 years, it's people being so disconnected from reality and people crawling so far up their own philosophical buttholes that they forget what it's like outside of their own philosophical buttholes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then they're just talking
cleaner
out their butts.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening. Like, they're peering through it like this and they're like, maybe we should kill everybody. How are you doing?
That's something. So, by the way, did you know that he's the guy that's widely credited as causing the beginning of the Tea Party?
Yeah, but that's it. I mean, it's just, but that's the argument. The argument is a dispassionate, I mean, the scary capitalist argument is a dispassionate appraisal. God, there's so much to say about this. Is a dispassionate appraisal of situation and do whatever is best economically.
Yeah.
And what's best economically for all the people he represents, especially as we further financialize the economy, so the people who are, there's only 48% of America owns any stocks to benefit the 48% of those people and disproportionately like just the top 1% of
which anyone. Which own 90% of
America. Right, exactly.
80 or whatever.
We should let people die. Actually, we should make people
die. Yeah, not let. We're going to inject them with it.
This is just a thought experiment.
And just to be clear, let's continue with this experiment. The WHO currently estimates, off of incomplete data, that the coronavirus death rate is 3.4%. The US Census Bureau estimated the population for the country last July was 328 million, which means that his proposal would kill 11 million Americans.
And 3.4%
seems like a lot.
If that's what the WHO is coming up with, it probably factors in like underdiagnosis.
You would assume, yes. And so, you know, the thing that I like about that is that generally, right wingers on TV say crazy things, but they sort of like hold it together and seem a bit journalistic. I like that he's like, he's standing in a crazy room and he's being as crazy as his idea actually is.
And just like something else, like this is the reason for progressivism. My best friend, no offense, in the world is a wanton capitalist. he's a wanton capitalist. And when I talk to him about regulations, he's like, there should be no regulations about anything. And this is the reason for progressivism.
Anything.
And his argument is, listen, if a product kills someone, they're gonna stop making it. But what you just saw, but no. that's not true. And
not true.
Progressivism was born essentially, maybe I'm definitely oversimplifying, but a factory caught fire and there was no protections for the people who worked there in terms of regulations to keep the workplace safe, and they had to jump out the window or burn alive. Now we have fire escapes because people were like, we need some kind of regulation to mandate that, like, we protect people who are vulnerable.
Yeah.
And then you have, but the counter argument is no. They would do that voluntarily because it would benefit them somehow economically. But the truth is, it's not okay if these people die.
Yeah.
If anyone dies because of this, and built into the legal system, then I'm sure that guy knows a bunch of lawyers, is if someone is culpable for someone else's death, we should probably hold them accountable.
I agree.
This guy's like, maybe we should just like pay
that. By the way, Don Jr. had said the Democrats want millions of people to die just so it'll hurt Donald Trump. He seems to be saying he wants millions of people to die because it'll help the economy. So that's a crazy thing. And with crazy rhetoric comes the need for crazy good apologies. So we're gonna play a bit of his apology and we're gonna adjudicate, should this guy be giving people financial advice online? Mm-hmm. Okay, here it is.
Yesterday, during a segment on The Exchange, I said maybe it would be a good idea to expose everybody to the coronavirus, to maybe it would be better off for the economy or the global economy or the markets in general. It was the dumbest, most ignorant, stupid thing anybody could have ever said. What was in my mind at the time, when I was young, and if you got measles, chickenpox, mumps, my parents and other parents would not only put family together, sometimes they bring other students together to expedite the process. It was just a stupid thing to say. It's not appropriate in this instance.
This happens. It's so perfect. He's on the floor of a stock exchange, basically, like about his career, going, turn these machines back on. But that's what happened when he was, and it's so sad. He's having the hangover after the party because behind him, the way the blood came out of his whatever, like he was like going crazy with like when like Bruce in Finding Nemo, the shark smells a little blood. Mm. Like when the floor of the stock exchange was open, he was like, let's kill everybody. And behind him, even then you saw a bunch of people being like, buy this. And like we wake up in the morning and all that stuff's happening.
Yeah.
But now, he wakes up the next day, he's like, oh, I did some things last night I really regret. And I think I mean, first of all, I'm buying a whole bunch of Pedialyte and I'm going to rehydrate. And then I need to apologize.
And the analogy, there are a few differences between giving kids chickenpox so that they don't have a higher chance of dying later on in life from that to giving people a disease that's killing thousands. Anyway, yesterday on the Damage Report, I said that all men should be put through a big meat grinder. Yes, I did say that. But what I was thinking at the time, what a weird thing to have to do in your career. But he's probably going to be fine because this is just one of the crazy things he said. Okay, we're going to take a short break, but even more to come after this. Mike Bloomberg spent so much money in his presidential run that we need some way to understand that, some way to visualize it, some way to process it. I think the best way that I've seen is the TikTok rice thing. Here's the worst.
See it as a possibility if he wants to spend $1 billion beating this guy, he could do it.
Absolutely. Somebody tweeted recently that actually with the money he spent, he could have given every American $1 million.
I've got it. Let's put it up on the screen. When I read it tonight on social media, it kind of all became clear. Bloomberg spent $500 million on ads. U.S. population, 327 million. Don't tell us if you're ahead of us on the math. He could have given each American $1 million and have had lunch money left over. It's an incredible way of putting it.
It's an incredible way of putting it. It's true. It's disturbing.
Is that true though? Because that's not how numbers work. He could give $1.35 something. $1.35. That's not how millions work. But that wasn't like a YouTube clip. That wasn't like a comment a Twitch streamer made. Like while they were busy doing something. That was a segment on the news.
We have On this show, you have, in terms of producers, you and two other people. Mm-hmm. Even with that, like even so, Angel and I write lower thirds for various shows. There is someone who makes them in the CG machine. I can't see who's on it today, but like you look up and someone's copying it. There's another set of eyes. And many times, after I reread my own things and send them in, I still don't catch something, but there's still someone going like, oh, that's stupid. And on a show like that on MSNBC, the sheer number of people who have to, maybe she sent in the graphic, she sent it to a producer. Mm-hmm. A high-ranking producer who probably said, can we please go make this graphic? And then someone else looked at it. Someone copied and pasted it. Someone even had it all prepped.
A person makes the graphic, a person loads the graphic. Like, somebody would notice it here. They have to have 10 times as many people.
They had to have a meeting about it. Like, what are we doing? Oh, yeah, what elements do we have for this show? Yeah, we got this one. Yeah. Let's see how that works. And when I saw this, it made its way around our Slack channel internally today. And my response was, oh, the humanities majors. There are no math majors working at MSNBC for sure. You got to go
probably
down around the hall and take a cab downtown to get to to CNBC for that to happen.
I want to be clear though, I think there's two people here who I feel bad for. So one is Mara Gay, the woman who was in the clip, because and mostly because she tweeted after the fact, buying a calculator, BRB, with the monkey covering the eyes. Okay, well, if you post that afterward, then you're great. I love you again.
Yeah, she's back in the
And also, by the way, the person who originally put out the tweet, I don't know, maybe if we put up the video, you can see the tweet again. That person, I noticed, all of their social media, their website is all private because they are probably being attacked nonstop, which, look, I don't know anything about Makeda Rivas. I don't. I'm going to assume, though, that what was meant by this was, I want you to know the cost to this and what could have been done. And many, many people have been expressing that thought. Yes, the math was wrong, but I believe the sentiment was right. So let's not harass someone into having to exile themselves from the internet. Now, Brian Williams, he has not put out a funny tweet.
And he said, going to pretend that that math was accurate.
So he's the villain, I think, at least up until this point.
He's funny too, man. Mm-hmm. Brian Williams is funny too, so he could drop a joke. He'd have to.
Let's see a tweet, maybe a Star Wars gif or something. Come on, save your reputation, man.
I mean, he's still in purgatory on the 11th hour. Like when you had the evening news, and now you're like, is Lawrence O'Donnell done? Can I come out of my hole? Like that's a problem.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, that's true.
But it bears, like, there are many other tweets out there whose math holds up, like how many Flint, Michigans, 10 Flint, Michigans you can fix with that. And so he did spend a lot of money. Let's not forget that. It was literally all in vain. Yeah. All it did, maybe, if you're trying to find the silver lining, is prove, no, you cannot buy an election.
Thank goodness. Yeah. And it's also a reminder that Brian Williams is not the villain, okay? And certainly Makeda and Mara are not. Bloomberg's the villain. Okay. Anyway.
You're telling me the billionaire news conglomerate owner is the villain?
Dun, dun, dun. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We come back. Garbage People of the Week. Now it's time to take out the trash. This is Garbage People. Brett's here with me. We've each chosen one garbage person. I'm gonna go first, partially because I have a video, which we don't normally have.
Do it.
And I'm very worried that we've chosen the same person. But first, I wanna let you know who my garbage person is. It is this woman, Hillary Rosen. You already know why, but in case you don't, here's why.
Referenced Dr. Martin Luther King before, saying that he said from the Birmingham jail that we should be concerned about white moderates. That's actually not what Martin Luther King said. What he said is we should be worried about the silence of white moderates.
Are you kidding me?
Nina, wait.
No, she's making a language point.
What he said was we should worry about the silence of white moderates. And what we have in Joe Biden is a man who is not silent.
The Reverend Chris, what Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was talking about, he said it is the point that the white moderate wants things to be comfortable. And instead of focusing in on that, the bigger threat is not necessarily the white KKK member, but more the white moderate that is more comfortable with keeping things the same or pretending like there is no tension.
Don't use Martin Luther King against Joe Biden. You don't have that. You don't have that standing.
First of all,
I'm sorry. You don't.
Don't tell me what kind of standing I have as a black woman in America. How dare you?
You have a lot of standing as a black woman in America. You don't have the standing to attack Joe Biden using Martin Luther King's words.
What are you doing? If that had been me, somehow, I would have finished the segment, unclipped my mic, walked out a window.
Just Tommened out the
room. Yep, just no prep.
God, that was so uncomfortable. I didn't she make it through the whole video.
While
the
Nina was talking, have you gone mad?
This ties exactly into, have you thrown her away? I forgot.
Oh, well, yes. I do want to read her apology, but here's her. You belong in here. You know you do. Really fast, her apology. It gets worse. Her apology. On air Thursday, I said my colleague Nina Turner didn't have standing to use MLK Jr. That was wrong. I am sorry for saying those words. Please, no need to defend me and attack angry black women. They have standing. I always need to listen more than I talk. We rise together. Don't reference angry black women.
And if there is a President Biden, we will get a government-funded Twitter edit button. Like, good God. That you can
she
see
has
there's
follow-up
two
apologies that get better, but
it's the fingerprints of idiocy and mistakehood.
There were some cuts.
More like editing many, many times to get it just right.
And not getting it anywhere near right.
Oh man, you can't. You can't do what she did. There's two spaces before angry black woman, which means she probably like stood there for a second going, what should I do? I mean, I don't know.
It's so utterly wrong about what was actually in that letter and horrible even if it hadn't been wrong.
It's every movie where the car careens off the cliff and like ends and they look over and go, they might have survived. And in that moment, like the biggest explosion you've ever seen off the edge of that cliff, man. That is so rough.
You know who's
cringe.
Terrible? Bernie bros. They're so rude. They're so arrogant.
I mean, I think there's obvious stuff that we're not going to get into. Like the obvious thing about telling Nina Turner she has no standing to talk about MLK, then following up with the black one.
And she's wrong about what's in it.
The
but
700,
anyway.
And yeah, it was comfort versus justice were the things like, and it's true. And I've told you that. So I just don't think, and I wasn't very familiar with this quote, but I was just like, it's not bad enough for the people that progressives need right now, maybe, is part of the conversation. But like, what a classic Joe Biden side tactic to take. We've seen it. I made a video where it's like Joe Biden, vote for someone else. Where when someone confronts him with a very real issue, he's like, step back, Jack.
Exactly. And
it's
he
like,
would
no,
say that.
Hear them out. Value their position. Mine is, my garbage person is the generic news pundit.
The first cartoon.
That's the first cartoon, but not the first meta concept. The generic news pundit. Who keeps asking like AOC questions about like, would you support the Democrat candidate? And goes up to Bernie is like, will you drop out? Think you got gotcha questions? Like, will you drop out if you don't have the plurality? And then is and like, just like it doesn't look like anything to me when the answer is, oh no, I'm principled in my stances.
Yes,
and
oh,
they're
I'm
like,
being consistent.
Compute. It's like Westworld where all the they just. Break apart, like watching Maddow get that answer. Be like,
I think that's the fembots of Austin Powers, but
I don't want to get into gender here. Generic news pundit. Come up with your own thoughts, and to them, they think that politics is a game. It is not.
Yes. Yeah. That was good, you know, because that question did frustrate me, but I didn't think about it. Okay, thank you so much, everybody. Check out not only Brett but also myself later on today on the Happy Half Hour, and thank you for joining. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.